spoken and written literature. Some valley texts were unwritten in two senses of the word. In the first place, they have not, after all, been written yet. In the second place, they never were written. They were oral texts. Those of the second kind included in this book have thus been translated twice, from Keshe into English and from Breath into print. And if you like, they can be translated back from print into breath, your breath. The Keshe distinguished writing and speaking, the written and the spoken word, not as two versions of one thing, but as different activities with a large area of overlap, different languages with a large but not total area of translatability. They saw as a primary distinction between the oral and the written text the quality of the relationship established. Undoubtedly, one can and will say, formally or informally, what one wouldn't write or wouldn't say knowing that it was being recorded. The writer's solitude might look like maximum freedom, but the immediate relationship between speaker and hearer, or hearers, may increase freedom by increasing trust. A writer, of course, may remain anonymous, as a speaker cannot, but anonymity or a pen name, denying the self, denies even the possibility of trust. Between writer and reader, the text itself mediates. It may be properly seen as a communication rather than a relation. In Keshe terms, the connection between writer and reader is not a present one. It is made in the non-present, in the houses of the sky. And so all written narration is in the forehouse mode. But speaking a text, prepared or improvised, and listening to it, constitute a relationship in the five houses of the earth, a connection of present contemporaries, people breathing together. The written word is there for anyone at any time. It is general and potentially eternal. The spoken word is here, to you, now. It is ephemeral and irreproducible. We might question the latter word, but mechanical reproduction, even the moving picture with sound, makes an image of but does not reconstitute the occasion, the time, the place, or the people there. The trust or confidence that can be established between writer and reader is real, though entirely mental. On both sides, it consists in the willingness to animate, to project one's own thinking and feeling into a harmony with a not-yet-existent reader, or a not-present and perhaps long-dead writer. It is a miraculous and entirely symbolical transubstantiation. When the artist and the audience are together, collaboration on the work becomes mundane and actual. The work shapes itself in the speaker's voice and the listener's response together. This powerful relationship can be, and in politics frequently is, abused. The speaker may appropriate the power to himself, dominating and exploiting the audience. When the power of the relationship is not abused, when the trust is mutual, as when a parent tells a bedtime story, or a teacher shares the treasures of the intellect, or a poet speaks both to and for the listeners, real community is achieved. The occasion is sacred. It would confuse things, however, to make a correlation of oral with sacred, written with secular literature in the valley, because the binary opposition, sacred-secular, was one they didn't make. There were indeed certain songs, dramas, instructions, and other oral texts connected with the great festivals and with sacred occasions or places, which they never wrote down or recorded in any way. For instance, the wedding song, sung every year at the World Dance, known to every adult in the valley, remained unwritten. It belonged to the breath, they said. To reproduce such a text would be, in their view, most inappropriate, not because it was sacrosanct, but because its oral, occasional, communal character was essential. When it was indicated to me that to record or transcribe would be inappropriate, I honored the request. A particular and valuable exception was made for me in the case of the death songs called Going Westward to the Sunrise, printed in the section called How to Die in the Valley, and discussed again below. We mostly seem to feel it appropriate and desirable that all spoken words, even office memoranda, recordings of private conversations, grandmother's tales, be saved on tape, stored in memory banks, transcribed, written, printed, preserved in libraries. Perhaps not many of us could say why we save so many words, why our forests must all be cut to make paper to mark our words on, our rivers dammed to make electricity to power our word processors. We do it obsessively, as if afraid of something, as if compensating for something. Maybe we're afraid of death, afraid to let our words simply be spoken and die, leaving silence for new words to be born in. Maybe we seek community, the lost, the irreproducible. Kesh poetry might be written down or might not. It might be improvised, memorized and recited, or read. But when read, even by a reader quite alone in a room, it was read aloud. A good many of the poems and songs in this book were not written down by their authors or performers, but they were pleased to have us do so. When poetry is a form of conversation, you might not try to record it all, but you do appreciate having your fine points noted. Other poems included here were written down by the author and given to the Hayamas, where they would be kept in the treasury or archives for a while, and eventually sorted through and the paper recycled, or the text recopied and taken home by somebody who wanted it, or otherwise dispersed. Still others were performed aloud at lodge teachings or other ceremonies. Some of these were common property, others were given by the breath by one individual, author or owner, to another. These were property as gift. I haven't tried to distinguish lyric poems from song lyrics. When I asked to write down the words of an improvisation or to record a song, the singer usually gave cordial permission, but not always. As a 14-year-old boy said when I asked him to repeat an improvisation so that I could tape it, "It was a dragonfly song. You can't make it come back." When writing down songs with a matrix of repeated syllables, the Kesh usually wrote only the syntactically meaningful words and omitted the matrix, which often constituted both the bulk of the song and the most deeply felt or meaningful part of it. But that meaning was, in their view, carried by the music and by the breath, and miscarried by the written letters. I think they were right. Instructions and descriptions of ritual and the order of a ceremony might be written or not written. I never found any consistent pattern. A hermetic tradition and a strong resistance to hermetic and esoteric practices ran side by side in the valley. The reverse of the situation of trust I spoke about above is that a secret is, after all, best kept by the breath. To write a word is to publish it. In her life story, Stone Telling refers to the mysteries of the lamb and warrior cults. Though these had all been exposed, spoken aloud, long ago, she still could not bring herself to write about them. The songs and instructions of Going Westward to the Sunrise were both esoteric and common, both written and unwritten. The songs, sung by and for a dying person, were held in reverence. They were learned only from a designated teacher, a member of the Black Adobe Lodge, and teaching and learning took place at a certain time of year in a certain place set aside, a house specially built, the typical temenos or holy ground. Yet there was nothing secret about the songs at all. All adults learned them sooner or later. Children heard them sung on the first night of the world dance. They were, in the fullest sense of the word, common property. Yet, though a learner might write them down to aid memorization, or the teacher write them for a person who had difficulty hearing an oral text, such transcriptions were always burned on the last night of the teaching period. The songs were never copied from writing and never printed. Their publication here is a privilege granted by my teacher of the lodge rejoining, Micah of Tsinshan, after careful consultation with people of the Black Adobe Lodge of Tsinshan and other towns. As for narrative fiction, it might be entirely oral, storytelling of traditional or extemporized tales, or it might be retold or read aloud from a text. This was often the method of the librarians, the more or less professional tellers of tales in prose and verse. Some narrative forms were entirely written texts, never performed aloud. Biography, autobiography, the romantic tales were transmitted by the hand, not by the breath, in manuscript or in print. Their essential character was to be there for anyone. The same is true for the great novels of the writers Marsh, Cowardly Dog, and Moat, which are, alas, far too long to include in this book, though I did get in a chapter of Word River's Dangerous People. Much of what I have said about written and spoken words applies in a general sort of way to music. The Keshe had an adequate system of musical notation, but they used it mostly for student exercises as a guide to practice. They did not choose to write down the score of any composition, though they might make a note of a tune, or of certain harmonies, or of matters of technique, such as tonguing or hinge breathing, etc., as a reminder. Music was transmitted in performance. But, most strikingly, they did not choose ever to record performance. They allowed the exchange to make and store electronic recordings when it asked to, and we were able to record a certain number of songs and performances, but in this we were doing something which they never did. And often it was tactfully indicated to us that replication of the music, of music, was a mistake, perhaps a mistake concerning the nature of time. Or, to put it another way, what we consider both desirable and necessary, they tended to consider a weakness and a needless risk, replication, multiplication. One note once only in the wilderness.